Incarcerated Mothers Matter. Thank you for listening to our second episode. Tonight we have a lot of good information for you from Incarcerated Mothers Matter, because here at Incarcerated Mothers Matter, we seek to help, to nurture, and to restore the material bond between mother and child while encouraging the reunification for the incarcerated by connecting them with outside sources. And without further ado, our guest tonight and co-host is Shanina McFarland. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I want to thank you in advance for stopping by and sharing with us tonight. So, Shanina, tell us a little bit about your story.
Daphne, thank you so much for having me on tonight. It is really an honor. Anytime I'm asked to speak and share my story, I hope it encourages someone to push through to the next day. I was incarcerated for 16 years in the federal system on a mortgage fraud charge. Prior to my incarceration, I was an attorney in the Atlanta area where I practiced real estate. I went to trial and was convicted, and the judge sentenced me to 30 years in federal prison as a first-time nonviolent offender. At the time, I had my daughter had just turned 4 years old, and I went off to prison. In 2020, I was released under the CARES Act program which was designed to place low-risk offenders on home confinement, meaning you wear an ankle monitor to reduce the population when COVID began to spread on the inside. I had done 50% of my time, so I qualified for that program. And on June the 9th, 2020, the little four-year-old girl that I left behind, who is now a 20-year-old woman, picked me up along with my parents and brought me to Atlanta to the halfway house where I stayed for a day or so, and then I was released home. And I thought that was truly my blessing. However, you know, God is just truly amazing, and he will not be outdone. So on the last day of President Trump's time in office, he commuted my sentence, which meant that my time was served, and I received executive clemency, which most people refer to as a pardon. And since then, I've been a very vocal advocate. I've been through too much, and God's brought me too far to forget what has occurred with me and what is in the hearts of all the women that I left behind. And it's been amazing, some of the wonderful women that I've met on this journey, Daphne yourself included. So I thank you once again for having me on the show tonight.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for being. When I thought about guests to tell their story, you know, you were one of the first people that, you know, popped in my mind, because I know you have such an amazing journey, you know, to be able to share with people and to show that, you know, God is in control, and that no matter what we go through, he's always there, and he's going to lead us in the direction, you know, we need to go.
Absolutely.
And tell us a little bit about, I know I have your bio here, and you've done so much in this short time since you've been home since June, of 2020. And, you know, just so involved. And I know you've gotten me involved and got me fired up, because, you know, that's one reason, you know, I wanted to start back reaching out and giving back, you know, to our sisters, you know, that we left behind. And, you know, just tell me a little bit about some of the advocacy and criminal justice things that you're working on, you know, now.
Well, I sit on several advisory boards. I sit on the board for Fighting for Freedom, Georgia Women on the Rise, the Atlanta Incarcerated Art Project. I am always willing to volunteer my time and talent, because there is so much work that needs to be done. So I would strongly encourage any listeners, if you have a few hours to spare, contact your local nonprofit that works in criminal justice reform and offer your time, because it can make such a difference. I speak at quite a few conferences. I tend to say more yeses than I do no when it comes to that. It's been easier since it's been virtual, but now that the country is opening back up again, they want you to appear in person. So lately I've been traveling a little bit, and I just keep focused on trying to bring women home and men too. My organization is called the Araminta Project. It's being formed now. And for those that don't know, Araminta was was Harriet Tubman's real name. And so it spoke to me, because it's about, if I can't go and unlock the doors of the prison, then I can try to get people out one by one. So I do that by being able to connect people with resources, with paralegals, with attorneys that are willing to take pro bono cases to help them in the various stages of their appeals, and also with helping them with compassionate releases to allow them to come home, because the COVID conditions inside, even though the country's opening up, people on the inside are still dying, and it is a very crucial state inside, and a lot of times people are unaware of what's going on with the prison population. And
we're going to talk about that in our next segment too, didn't mean to interrupt you, but I know me and you had, discussed some things about what's going on still and, you know, what was going on, like, at the beginning of it. And
right.
So I know we're going to touch on that a little bit more, too, coming up. Sorry to interrupt you.
No problem. So basically, I'm based out of Atlanta, and I currently work with Ladies of Hope Ministries. I'm their administrative in-reach coordinator, which means I'd work on bringing programming and reentry services into facilities so that when women come out, they have the support system that they need to be able to get on their own 2 feet. And it's really amazing and gratifying work.
That is so awesome. I know, too, you know, your story has been, you know, featured on NPR, StoryCorps, you know, PBS NewsHour, you know, on Sirius Radio and iHeartRadio. So that is just so important, you know, for stories like these to get out. Because a lot of times we don't get to hear about, you know, the good things that, you know, that are being done as well. And I certainly know it was a blessing, you know, to be able to receive that, you know, presidential executive, you know, clemency, you know, from the president on his last day. And, you know, I know that would be something, you know, that you would, you know, never forget. And I know also today one of our major topics we're going to talk about is the spread of COVID in the federal prison system. I did not get to witness per se a lot that was going on because I was able to come home a month before, you know, before the major lockdown. The information that I'm getting now is actually from an NPR article that talked about, you know, the beginning and how the Attorney General then, Bill Barr, you know, sent a memo to the BOP director about prioritizing home confinement for people. Can you tell me a little bit how that process went with you all there being able to come home under the CARES Act?
Well, as in most of the Bureau of Prison policies, well-intended and poorly executed, it was designed to alleviate the overcrowded conditions within the prisons and the inability to social distance. For many of you that I don't guess you've probably given much thought to the number of people that are in a correctional setting, but for the FCIs, which are Federal Correctional Institutes, and the camps, the work camps that are within the federal system, we are not housed in cells. We are housed in cubicles. So it's not actually a room in most locations. I mean, there are some exceptions depending on where the prison is, but for the most of the ones I know, Tallahassee, Mariana, Coleman, these are female facilities. They are cubicles, which means that there's no wall, and so it's impossible. If someone coughs, I mean, even when the general flu goes around, it usually runs rampant through the housing unit because you have people that are sharing space, they're touching the same sinks and toilets and showers, and it's just impossible to social distance. Also, there's not sufficient cleaning supplies. You aren't allowed to have any kind of bleach or things that would really kill germs for security purposes. So you're required, you know, you try to use soap, and then what happens with that is that they run out, and you have to buy your soap from commissary. So some of the commissaries offer like Dial antibacterial, but once that's sold out, you're just out of luck. And so unfortunately, when it comes in, it comes in with a vengeance. Those of us that were inside knew what it was going to be like if and when COVID made it inside. And they did a national lockdown where they tried to isolate us, but that's technically impossible when your staff is going home every day to their, you know, wives, husbands, and children. And they're still going to school. They're not wearing masks. And you're, you know, interacting with them. And then you're coming to work and interacting with the prison population. And that is how it was introduced and what caused it to spread further, to the point that we had a we knew about reinfection far before the CDC even acknowledged that it was possible to get reinfected, because there were people who had been who had COVID more than one time, and with each time,
wow,
it weakens your immune system even more. And also the medical care at the prison on the best day is horrible. So for a population of 1,000 women, you may have two nurses, a couple of techs, and one doctor. And it is, you know, it's very hard to be seen for anything. And so we end up having to nurse each other, which means that the virus is being spread even more so. So then they started with the quarantining, where if you exhibited any symptoms, you were moved to a quarantine unit. But if you were asymptomatic, you just stayed in the regular unit and just continued to infect other people. So it was a no-win situation. And so they began to process people who were considered minimum or out custody, meaning low-level offenders, and they had served a significant portion of their time, usually 50%, and they had no disciplinary infractions. So those of us that met that criteria were processed out, and then we were given an ankle monitor and placed on home confinement, for which we were only allowed to leave the house for work purposes or for medical purposes, or if we had we could go to get a pass to go to, say, Walmart or the grocery store once a month. And other than that, you were confined to the house. And so for those people that felt that there was just this mass exodus of prisoners being released into the world, that's not what happened at all. As a matter of fact, a lot of us found home confinement to be far more restrictive than the environment that we had inside the prison with being able to move around the compound. Not that anyone would complain about being home, but it was not this get-out-of-jail-free card that a lot of the conservatives like to portray home confinement as being.
Right. I was looking at some statistics, and it was saying as of early March of this year, more than 38,000 people had been released to home confinement during the pandemic. Of 9,000 of those, you know, it was only 9,000 that qualified under the CARES Act, because home confinement existed, you know, before the pandemic. But that was a choice that the BOP didn't use a lot, because up until recently, because of the CARES Act, no one could really apply. You know, you couldn't apply for it. You couldn't send your motions into the court. You had to go through the judge and the warden to ask for permission if you could apply for it. And then if they said yes, then you went through the court process. And for a lot of people, they didn't even get the opportunity to apply for it. And it said, in 2020, of all the motions filed, it was only 96 inmates who themselves filed a motion, because it was about time they went through that lengthy process and everything was weeded out. It was only 96. But after the First Step Act that enabled inmates to be able to file their own motions, nearly 13,000 motions were filed in the federal court. So it shows you the difference of, you know, things being controlled. I know the pandemic is awful, you know, was awful and still is, you know, because we're not over it yet. But, you know, the First Step Act did, you know, offer a way for, you know, people to be able to have more access
to the court to get motions and stuff in, but then you also had, you know, that put a backlog as well, you know, because so many things were being filed and, you know, courthouse, you know, federal buildings being closed down because of COVID and everything. So it said one in four that filed a motion in the court for compassionate release due to COVID, they actually died before, you know, their motions could even be granted. So, you know, that was pretty, you know, pretty harsh, you know, one in four, you know, and these people, you know, a lot of them too were elderly people, people, you know, who already had pre-existing conditions like diabetes, congestive heart failure, any respiratory illnesses, and, you know, even just being, like you say, being able to get adequate medical care. And, you know, it's just like you said earlier about, you know, the BOP has excellent plans, but, you know, is very hard for execution. And so, you know, a lot when they were asked, you know, questions, you know, they always say, oh, yeah, you know, everything's okay. We got it in control. We got a COVID, you know, protocol. You know, we have this. And really, they didn't have the things in place, but and it was okay, you know, to ask for help. And things probably might have been somewhat better if, you know, they just, you know, let other agencies come in and help as well, you know, with that.
Well, I think the only true remedy to the situation would have been to decrease the population. And I don't believe that they fully utilized that ability. When you have an ankle monitor on, it's GPS, and they're able to locate you within 3 feet anywhere on the planet. They can't even do that when you're inside of a facility. So that's the public safety factor, really, for those people that were nonviolent, was really not an issue, even though they made it one to try to stop people from being able to come out, because an empty bed doesn't make the prison money, and that's what it all
right.
comes down to.
Right.
And,
we talked about that last week, about it being
right.
Business.
And prison labor drives a lot of the, you know, the entire system. So without bodies to perform the, particularly with the satellite camps for women that support the larger male institutions, without the women being there to run the warehouses and the unicorns and all of those situations, there, if staff has to do it, the budget would crumble in a heartbeat because, you know, they're not going to be able, they can pay an inmate $12 and 12 cents an hour, rather, as opposed to, you know, a staff member where they would be paying them for overtime. So
right.
those are all factors that that weighed in. One of the biggest things was the fact that home confinement was expanded under the CARES Act to allow for more than 6 months, because prior to the CARES Act being passed, home confinement was limited to the last 6 months of your sentence. So now there was no limit on the amount of time. So there are some people, myself would have been included, had I not received clemency, that would have had, I would have had almost 12 years left to serve on an ankle monitor. And
wow.
now there's a bigger issue as the pandemic is about to be designated to be an endemic. Will the Bureau pull those people that have longer sentences back in? And this is a huge issue, because when you come out on the on home confinement, you're responsible for your own welfare and upkeep. So the Bureau doesn't give your family a check or anything to take care of you. You have to get a job, or your family has to help you out. So you're talking about people that have been home for almost 2 years. So they've gotten jobs, they've gotten cars. In some cases, they've moved into their own housing. And most importantly, they've bonded with their families and their children again. So
yes.
here's someone who's out doing everything that they're supposed to do, and now you're telling them that they may have to go back. And that is just would be the most cruel and inhumane thing that I could imagine. It's hard to have to leave your family one time, but to have to do it twice when you haven't done anything wrong and you've done everything right, is just unconscionable. And so there has been a concerted effort to pressure the Biden administration into either granting a mass clemency for those people, or there was a memo that came out in January of this year in which the Bureau said they would evaluate it on a case-by-case basis, but that the length of time remaining on home confinement would be a weighted factor. So, you know, if I was able to come out and function, why do you need to send me back? And what happens to my family? What happens to, you know, everything that I've worked to establish? It just seems self-defeating.
Yes.
And those are some of the things that we have to think about at this point in time.
Right. And it's like you said, especially that, you know, that bond with those children, you know, it's only hurting the, you know, hurting the children. And like you said, you know, having to rip the children away from their parents, you know, another time, you know, that's cruel and inhumane. And, you know, like you said, and especially when people are doing what they're supposed to do. And, you know, have a reentry plan, you know, and, you know, they are reporting like they're supposed to, also putting money back into the economy, because some of the jobs that are being done are jobs that other people, you know, may not want to do or can't do, you know, especially with the pandemic. So that is you know, very, very important, even for the outside, you know, economy. And like you said, too, it's a two-way street. You know, they talk about the cost of housing a person, but that burden of housing an inmate that's nonviolent, you know, low maintenance, you know, low-level security person, you know, is better off at home, because that takes the burden, you know, too, off of the federal system, you know, as well, you know.
And
so
I really believe, Daphne, that if the average taxpayer could see what people did at low and camp level facilities, they would insist that they be closed immediately and these people go home to get jobs, because you have people that work. Sometimes there's a job such as wiping windows, and you work an hour a day, and the rest of the day you're free to sleep, read, play cards, play games. And it does nothing, and you're guaranteed three meals a day, and you know you're given your clothing. They do your laundry for you. It is really, other than the fact of being away from your family, it is not a hard life. And so for even myself as an attorney, I never thought about what happened to my clients when they went to prison. In my mind, I guess I thought about, you know, the cup clanging on the bars, or them out marching, mm-hmm. or them working in the fields, or something along those lines, buying into what TV shows us. But in actuality, it's none of that. You're allowed to watch TV all day if you choose to do so. You can crochet. You can do arts and crafts. It is really a very low-stress environment, unless you make it stressful. But for the most part, these people would be better off at home raising our children than we are in being incarcerated. Particularly, there's a huge segment of white-collar criminals, and, you know, people are always saying, oh, well, you know, they should have to pay the, you know, okay, fine, put them in for 6 months and then let them come out and pay the rest of the debt off. It doesn't have to be an overkill when it comes to the sentencing, because long sentences, these huge draconian sentences that people are getting, it does nothing. It does nothing except destroy families.
Yes, and I had a caller last week we ended up with, and he was talking about, you know, like some people having to pay, you know, that, you know, their victims and their families. And I was trying to explain to him as well, being incarcerated, making 12 cents an hour, and if a person gets 20 years, they'll never be able to help their victim and, you know, or help victim family that might have to take care of someone because, number one, they won't make enough money on the inside to do that. And number two, you know, people, you know, would be, like you said, better off at home where they're monitored. They can go to work and, you know, make a decent wage to be able to manage what they have to and, you know, pay back whatever they need to, you know, pay back. One other thing I wanted to ask you, can you just, like, kind of describe, I know your daughter was 4 years old when you left. Can you kind of just describe a little bit how you were able to just really parent? Because I know your daughter, she is such an awesome, magnificent young lady. And I know that that was hard for you. I know for me it was a little bit different because my children had finished high school. But can you just describe what that was like, you know, trying to be a parent and micromanage everything with the limited, like, visitation and phone time and stuff that we had to be able to communicate?
Well, it takes a lot of work, and I have to say that I'm truly blessed to have two of the most wonderful parents on earth that always made sure that I got to see my daughter no matter what part of the country the Bureau chose to send me to. And but even during that time, you know, visitation is typically a Friday, Saturday, or Sunday for 6 hours. And even if they come all 3 days, that's really not a lot of time. However, you have to make it count. And, you know, my daughter and I, we corresponded from the time that she was, you know, 4 years old. I mean, she couldn't write, but she would color me pictures. And I would color her pictures. I would send her blank pictures out of a coloring book and have her color them and send them back to me. And I would write her a letter that my mother would read to her. And when she started being able to write, I would get the big cornbread papers with letters on there where I could see where she was trying to make a A or a B, and she wrote it backwards and then she erased it. But I got to see that. Unfortunately, now a lot of the prisons are not allowing even children to, you know, for their parents to even receive drawings and things from them any longer, claiming that it's being used as a method to introduce contraband into the system, namely drugs. However, we all know that the drugs are really being brought in by the officers, but that's a whole nother topic. But they don't, now they want to photocopy your mail. And you get just a photocopy of it. So you're not able to have that sheet of paper that your child actually touched. I would spray my letters with perfume, the same perfume that I would wear to visit. And my daughter would tell me, she tells me now, yeah, my letters always, you know, they smelled like you. So I would put them on my pillow. And then if I made her a blanket or crocheted her something, I would sleep with it for a few days and then send it to her so it would smell like me. And then, you know, it was a lot of cards, a lot of crafts that were, you know, hats, gloves, scarves. I can remember one time my mother wrote me and says, "Sweetheart, please stop spending your money on yarn because everybody in the family has a blanket, a hat, and a scarf and mittens and slippers." Perhaps you should look at donating them somewhere else. And I had to laugh. So then what we did was we put all of them together and we donated them to a cancer wing for the patients. So, I mean, there are ways to keep in touch. I wrote her letters and I would seal them and I would write on the outside of the letter, "Read this when you're happy," or "Read this when you're sad," or "Read this when you're missing me," or "Read this when somebody bothered you at school," and I would seal them up into little envelopes and send them to her, and then she would read it on the appropriate day, so it would be not the same as me being there for her to talk to, but she would know what my thoughts were on the subject. And the hardest thing was adults guilting her about me being in prison. And I would tell anyone that does it, the child is not responsible for whatever it is that the parent did. And so they should not have to bear the punishment. Children will be cruel because they don't know any better. Adults will just be messy. And it's wrong. And when you hear another adult doing that, you know, we all need to step up and say, hey, that's not okay.
Yeah. It's like you say, you know, witness of, you know, a lot of women with younger children and things that you said, you know, even people can benefit that's not, you know, incarcerated to stay closer, you know, to their kids, you know, during the time. And like I had mentioned last week about, you know, the phone calls and, you know, being able to do video visits so you can, you know, see, you know, to see them and, you know, just really trying to keep that maternal bond, you know, going. So, you know, with, you know, the transformation. Did you get to take the parenting class? I know it's, you know, been a while. But I know they, you know, offered, like, the parenting classes and, you know, some other things that, you know, also taught you, you know, how to address different subjects, you know, to the children.
Well, my counselor and I had a disagreement about the parenting class because I explained to them that according to the Bureau of Prisons, my daughter would be 32 years old by the time I was released. So if they really wanted me to parent, they should let me go home.
Gotcha.
And so I for a long time resisted taking the parenting class. And then when I did take it, I found it to be very superficial. It was just a series of videos, just, you know, telling you how to discuss things with your child, written from a context of a psychologist with no understanding of what it's like to deal with an incarcerated parent and child. And so, no, I didn't get a lot out of it. The best
right.
advice that I got regarding parenting came from other ladies that were incarcerated that were inside with me that guided me on what to do and how to deal with it when my daughter went through her terrible teenage years where she was, you know, giving my mother fits. They were able to help me with that, you know, when she was when at visitation, when she would cry, you know, when she was leaving, and I would try to hold it together until I got on the outside of the door, and then I would be crying, and I'd fall in the arms of one of my, you know, other friends who would, you know, hold me until I could get over it, because that is the hardest thing. It's like a heartbreak every weekend. You don't want to give up your visit. You know, you want to see them, but, you know, you all start watching the clock as it gets closer to 3 o'clock and you start dreading it because you know that the goodbye is coming. And so you have to figure out a way to get through that. And I would tell people, if you know someone, if you know grandparents or aunts or uncles or cousins or whoever that are raising the children of incarcerated parents, if you can in any way donate funds so that they can be taken to see their mother or father, that is like the most amazing thing that you can do. In lieu of that, if you can go to some of the websites that do pictures for inmates, like Photo Pigeon and some of the other ones, and you know, send them pictures directly from your phone of their children, because that's the thing that we need to see. We want to know how our kids are doing, what they look like, how they're feeling. And it doesn't have to be isolating. Even though you're not in the same place, it is possible for you to parent successfully from prison.
Gotcha. Yeah, the pictures were always important. I think everybody, you know, knew everybody's children and was invested, you know, with each other's kids because, you know, we were without them. And, you know, you always knew when somebody had a problem with one of the children, you know, even to be able to, you know, take it to church and, you know, pray for someone's kid that's going through, you know, a difficult situation. So,
you know, that community of mothers was just so important. So that's the reason, one of the reasons I wanted to start this organization, because I knew how important, you know, it was for me to have, you know, friends around me that helped me understand that, you know, what I was going through, or, you know, talking me through it and saying, you know, it's going to be okay, or, you know, well, they'll get, you know, better. My child went through the same thing and they ended up, you know, being better. So that, you know, that was just one thing, because it just, it still takes a community, and you got to have the community inside to help, and then you have the community that's on the outside. And I applaud all family members, friends, you know, that help out, you know, with kids who have incarcerated parents, because they are very, very important and vital. They don't know, you know, how vital they are, like you say, even to be able to, you know, take, you know, even to offer a ride, you know, to take them, you know, to see their parents, you know, that is just that, you know, that's so important, you know, even for the kids, you know, to be able to do that. Let's see what else we can talk about here on my list. And like right now, like with your organization that you're creating right now, I'm so excited to hear about it, and I hope you get to come back and be able to, you know, tell us about that as well. And I see you have an upcoming book as well that's coming out. What is the basis for your book, Collateral Consequences?
Well, Collateral Consequences talks about essentially my journey through the from the indictment phase all the way through my release. And it's just a journey, almost like a epic saga of what I encountered, the good, the bad, the ugly, the beautiful. And hopefully it'll be out this summer. And at least my editor is really pushing me to have it out by this summer. But it's just a tale of my truth as I went through the criminal justice system, having taken an oath as an attorney to uphold the system, to then being prosecuted by that system and ultimately sentenced to serve time within that system. So it's, a perspective of, you know, of my multifaceted journey through the justice system.
Awesome. Awesome. And I also see here, too, that you've been able to be a faculty member as well. I mean, even your experience is just, you know, so vast that I know that you get, you know, offered to, you know, speak at so many different, you know, educational events as well.
Right. So talk about irony of the utmost. So when I was convicted of my felony, I was ultimately disbarred from the practice of law in Georgia. And yet and still this past August, I was a faculty member, and I had 180 some odd attorneys in my class through the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. They had me to teach a class. And so it was funny to me that here this disbarred attorney is teaching attorneys about the importance of recognizing their clients as people and not just case files, which is what I talked about. And, you know, that people are more than just numbers, case numbers in a system, that when you encourage someone to plea, it's not just that person that's pleading. It will mean that a child will grow up without a father or a mother. You know, there's a lot to be weighted into that decision, not just to move things expeditiously down a calendar for the sake of judicial economy. And that was an amazing experience. I just was asked to come back at the end of this month and sit on another panel as a faculty for the
awesome.
Same organization. So I am excited about that. I don't have a desire any longer to practice law. So people ask me, well, now that, you know, you've received your clemency, will you go back and apply to get your license back? The answer is no, I won't. I don't have a desire. I don't think in good faith I could take the oath again and uphold something in a system that I know is irretrievably broken. So in turn, I will just continue to be an advocate and owe nothing to anyone so that I can really speak my truth and the truth of all those who don't have the voices to be heard because they're behind the walls.
And I know we've been talking about, the criminal justice stuff and reform and COVID, but what do you like to do for fun? What is your fun day?
Is having my daughter home and my parents with me, and probably some aunts and uncles and cousins, and we're all in my kitchen and I'm cooking, and we're all arguing about if whether or not the onions that are going in. If first of all, do onions go in potato salad? And secondly, how big should they be chopped up? You know, we have these debates, and just really just spending time with my family is the most amazing thing. One thing about prison is that it allows you to appreciate the smallest things in life. And my mother recently, she came into my room, and I have a walk-in closet in my bedroom, and I was in there. And I have a little stool that I used to get up onto the higher shelf. And I was sitting on the stool, and I was just crying my eyes out. And my mother's like, what is wrong with you? You know, what happened? Are you okay? Is everything all right? And I'm like, Mom, I just realized my closet is bigger than the room that I lived in for, you know, 16 years. And I'm just so grateful. And,
yeah.
You know, it just gives you a different perspective. One thing about prison, you learn to wait patiently for everything. So while everybody is in the line at Publix or Kroger and they're huffing and puffing at how long the register is, you know, the line is to get to the register, I'm looking around just enjoying being out. So it gives you a totally different perspective on life. You learn not to sweat the small things. And it is just, I don't know, it's just different. But yeah, being around my family is my source of joy.
Great. What was one of the first places you wanted to go when you got home?
Oh, wow. Well, I didn't get to go anywhere because I was on home confinement.
Yeah, but after the home confinement.
when I got the notice of my clemency on January the 20th, the first place that I went was to, the next morning was to the halfway house so they could cut my ankle monitor off. And then and then it was also the day of the inauguration. And so then I went over to my cousins and we had a brunch that was we celebrated. We were all wearing tucks and pearls in honor of Kamala. And we had a brunch, and then they made me this T-shirt that said "Free at Last," and so they had all this food, lobster tails and shrimp and all sorts of things that they know that I like to eat, crab legs, and we just sat around and ate, but it was like a really good experience. But yeah, so I still haven't gone to, like, I want to go to the aquarium here in Atlanta. I haven't made it there yet, but that's on my bucket list of things to do in the short term.
Gotcha. I mean, this has just been really, really awesome, talking with you today and for you to share with us, what's going on, with you and with the organizations. Do you have, any other, website or email or
social media that people could like contact you if you know they had questions or wanted to volunteer with any of the projects that you're doing?
You can reach me on Instagram at Shalana, Chalana, Shay, Chay, or you can email me at Shalana, Chalana, at the Loam, THELOHM, which is the acronym for the Ladies of Hope Ministries. So Shalana at the Loam.org is my email, so people can feel free to reach out through either of those. And also I'm on LinkedIn as well, Shalana McFarland. So any of those sources. Or they can contact you, Daphne. You know how to reach me.
Yes. You can contact me, and we have our Facebook page, which is Incarcerated Mothers Matter. And also, you can also email me at Daphne, D-A-P-H-N-E, the letter P, 309@gmail.com. And also, by telephone, if anyone that you know of that maybe have some questions about what we talked about, the First Step Act, 2255, motions, I also am a consultant for Second Chance for Real and Top Flight Evaluations, and we're accepting clients to be able to help some of these people, you know, help people come home and be able to file their right paperwork. And that phone number is 716-495-6756. And that's 1-7-6-4-9-5-6-7-5-6. And you also can go to the website. It's www.secondchance, and that's all spelled out, Second Chance, the letter number 4, real.com. And that's www.secondchance, the number 4, the word real.com. You can get all kinds of information there about the different programs that are going on with the Second Chance for Real Foundations and the other programs that they're working with community projects, with housing, the legal services, and, you know, just being able to file your paperwork and getting you're getting our family members home. Is there anything else that you'd like to close with, Shay?
I just want to once again thank you for having me on the show, and I would ask for all of the listeners to get involved. Please get involved. There are people that desperately need your help, and just – even the smallest gesture can make the biggest of difference. So thank you, Daphne, for having me, and have a wonderful night.
All right, and thank you so much for joining us. Thank you. Thank you so much. And just thank the listeners for joining us tonight for Incarcerated Mothers Matter. We really appreciate all of you all listening to us and sharing, and we look forward to you know, more listeners joining us. Next week I have another great guest that will be here, and we will do the advertising for her coming up in the next couple of days. So I really want you all to be on the lookout for her. She is going to really share some great information with us. And this information, you know, that we've gotten tonight, you know, has been so informative, you know, about what's going on and about, you know, just the changes and, you know, the different laws and how things, you know, really are. Versus, you know, what we see on the news or,
you know, read in papers or especially seen in movies, because it's a whole different world. I know movies have to sensationalize to make money and make things look, you know, a whole different way. But it is so different from when you look at a movie. I know whenever I look at a movie, I think, wow, no way, it's not that way, you know, and it makes me laugh a lot because everything is so different. And we want to make sure, too, you know, that we keep getting our vaccinations. You know, those that believe in getting vaccinated, you know, keep update too on the CDC website for the CDC guidelines as we get to this portion of the epidemic that, you know, that we're going through. I know it's a lot of other things that are going on with the gas prices going up and, you know, inflation. And so all of these things not only affect us, families, you know, they affect everyone, even people that are incarcerated, because now that gas is higher, they, you know, it might be less visits. But I know right now a lot of places aren't even, you know, allowing visits, you know, still due to COVID and things like that. But, you know, we'll just, you know, keep the faith and, you know, keep looking out for each other and keep everyone in prayer, because we know that with God, all things are possible. And I look forward to everyone tuning in with me next week. It'll be the same time, the same station. And also, if you want to hear the replay of this, you can go back to the original link that you you signed in on, or the flyer link that was sent out, and just click it, and it will take you to our replay. And so thank you, everyone, tonight for listening and tuning in, and we will see you on next Thursday. Good night.
Just like a bird, I just want to fly free,
so
and I own a piece of land somewhere off in a country. Oh, hey, listen. Temperatures like 100 degrees. Like I got chains for me. Black mill in the family of three. Been proud of my destiny. Reckon I'll fly away, cause it's too much for the man. Shouldn't have gone down this way. What happened to my master plan? Cause I can't figure out, I could have been a love child. Shouldn't have gone down this way. Tell me, how did I get lost? Oh, yeah. Talk to me. Oh, how did I get lost? Tell me, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh. Home, yeah. Just about to see the dollar.